Gary Lemieux.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Friday afternoon and another agenda on the Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Glad to see a large audience today to hear about the Business Development Department. We're happy to have Director Tim McCabe and Paul Grove here, so open an informational meeting on Business Oregon's legislative overview. So, Director McCabe, if you'd like to get us started. We heard from Director Garrett at our last meeting, and we're eager to hear your sense of where we stand in the state, and with particular emphasis on the things that you'd like to see from this legislative session.
Chair Reed, Co-Chair Benz, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tim McCabe. I am Director of the Oregon Business Development Department, also known as Business Oregon. And I want to just say up front, I've been under the weather, so I'm not answering any difficult questions today.
So we'll see if the committee accepts that kind of response. Go right ahead. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're here despite that under the weather nature.
We've passed out. This is an overview of the department, but I'm not going to go into that. You can read this at your leisure, but it gives you a good understanding of what we do, our short-term efforts, our short-term issues that we're facing, and more long-term, what we're envisioning for the state, and then our long-term issues. So we address that. What I really want to do is actually talk about my department and our successes and what we do on a daily basis. Over the past year, we help and maintain and create thousands of jobs for Oregonians. Over the past year, and I'm going to use one example, we used one of our funds to a total of $6.9 million, and it helped create 12,750 direct and indirect jobs, and it returned $55 million to the general fund. I bring that out because on the Business Oregon side of the house, our funding is lottery dollars, and our total budget for the biennium was $32 million. So my point is this: we've returned $55 million in revenue to the state on an investment of $6.9 million and created over 12,000 jobs. I'd say that's a pretty good return on investment. When you look at our whole portfolio, we created over $400 million in new state economic activity just in the last year. We also work on innovation investments. We give Oregon companies access to technologies. 227 Oregon companies have used the research labs that have been created by Oregon Inc., the Oregon Innovation Council. We, as a state, have put in $42 million and we have leveraged over $250 million additional dollars, federal dollars, to go along with that. That's a $7 for every dollar that the state has invested in technology. I'd say that's a pretty good return on investment as well. Business Oregon, we fill the gaps between federal, state, and local resources so more business development projects benefit Oregon communities. We're a one-stop shop. We build water, wastewater, sewers, as well as working with businesses, so we make those communities successful. We also help Oregon business access global markets. Oregon exported $16.2 billion in 2010, up 20% over 2009. And I'll give you a couple of examples of our successes there. We took Bramall Motorsports down to in Ashland, Oregon. They make the electric motorcycles. We tied them up with a distributor in Hong Kong, Jackie Chan Advanced Marketing. It is that Jackie Chan. He's very excited about electric vehicles, so he's marketing them. He put them in touch with the Hong Kong Police Department. The Hong Kong Police Department currently has 250cc motorcycles, and by the year 2014, they were going to replace all of those motorcycles with electric motorcycles. So we custom built 10 electric motorcycles that the Hong Kong Police Department is currently testing over there. And if they're successful, this will be millions of dollars. We also helped them at a trade show in Milan, Italy. We invested $2,500 to help them be a part of that trade show, and they got an order for $5 million in electric motorcycles. I'd say that's a pretty good return on investment. Those are the things we do on a daily basis, and those are just a couple of examples of how we connect Oregon companies to external markets. As I said, our Infrastructure Finance Authority provides financing critical to improving public health and safety communities. In 2010, the IFA awarded $109 million in grants and loans towards 103 Oregon infrastructure projects. Our film and video office that put Oregonians to work and drive millions of dollars into local economies. Spending on feature films and television series in Oregon totaled more than $62 million in 2009. From 2007 to December 2010, the total direct spending in Oregon on Oregon Production Investment Fund and Greenlight Oregon projects, the two film incentives managed by the Film and Video Office, amounted to $178 million, and the direct and indirect impact on our economy was $350 million, with the annual wage for the industry of $53,118. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I suspect that there may be many. Mr. Grove, did you want to have any opening comments as well?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. No questions so far. Representative Bentz. And then Nathanson.
Glad you're here, and glad you're 20 feet away from me.
I guess food poisoning, Representative Bentz.
Sure.
but I'll shake your hand later.
I guess when it comes to the department determining how it's going to invest its really limited resources, I'd be interested in how that thinking occurs and whether the department looks to outside consultants and where we in Oregon, as what the legislature, look to get good ideas when it comes to economic development. Do we? And in asking that question, it's not to undersell what you've done, because obviously you've been a success. I'm just curious in how the thinking occurs and who's doing it.
Okay. Co-Chair Bentz, members of the committee, that's a very good question. We're very fortunate to have a very, very talented commission that oversees the department that we report to on a bi-monthly basis. And the direction we get, and one of the things that I incorporated when I restructured the department, was to take more direction from the commission, because our commission is led by Chair Wally Van Valkenburg. He's the managing partner of Stoll Reeves, one of the largest law firms, and his specialty is intellectual property. And Wally is a very committed citizen and cares a great deal about this state and what happens within it. We also have Junki Yoshida. For those of you don't know, he's the he pioneered Yoshida sauce, which is in turn was bought by Heinz. But he also owns a huge logistics company and handles Nike shipping throughout the world. Help me out here, Paul. We have Ann Root, an entrepreneur from Southern Oregon. She owns a winery, bed and breakfast. She also makes the seasoning that go on potato chips, Lay's potato chips, and other products, and that's made up in Wilsonville.
Steve Emery, from Central Oregon, CEO of Earth2O, owner CEO, and Greg Semler from the Portland area as well. Tony Hyde, Columbia County Commissioner, and Chandra Brown at OIW as well. So a very talented commission.
So in answer to your question, Representative Bentz, 2 years ago we took them on a retreat, and they identified the five industries or industry sectors that we concentrate our efforts on. Those are high-tech manufacturing, outdoor gear and apparel, wood products. These are specialized wood products. What are the other two?
Clean tech, advanced manufacturing.
Clean tech and advanced manufacturing. And I'm sorry, I'm a little bit off today, so.
We know why. It's okay.
But and I think you'll see in that Business Oregon overview document that was handed to you as well, in terms of the short-term efforts, long-term efforts, you can see where the direction has been focused as well, in terms of those limited resources, whether it be direct investment in companies, access to capital, those types of activities.
Well, please.
So the focus of what we're doing in this arena is driven by past success, but I'll just put this out. If you were asked to select one area and we took all $32 million and spent it there, which would it be? Which one of these areas is going to return to Oregon the most long and short term? Because it does, I can't help but think that we are scattered. We would have to be. There's lots of different opportunities, but I'm just curious. Is there one area, exports comes to mind, but is that where you would spend all that money if you were forced to select one area?
Co-chair Bence, members of the committee, no. If I were forced just to choose one, I would just work specifically on the loan funds that we manage, the Oregon Business Development Fund, the Credit Enhancement Fund, and those funds, because those are the things that day in and day out that Oregon businesses need. So I would concentrate our efforts solely on existing Oregon business, keeping them alive. And that's, over the last 2 years, those two funds have been pivotal to hundreds of businesses in this state to keep them going. The Credit Enhancement Fund is an example. That is a fund that we just hold in reserve, and we guarantee loans by banks. And we work closely with community banks. For every dollar we have in that fund, we've got, well, that fund now stands at $7 million. It was $11 million 2 years ago. But on that $7 million, we have roughly $19 million in loans out there sitting behind those. When it was at $11 million, we had almost $30 million leveraged out there. So on our business development fund, for every dollar we put into a loan and we work with our partners in the banks, there's five additional dollars that go in from other sources. So those are the things that, you know, Oregon businesses need. And when you look at the overall job picture, and it's pretty much the same rule of thumb today as it was 10 years ago, 80% of the new jobs that are created in the state come from existing businesses, not from outside of the state.
Thank you.
Yep. Representative Nathanson, then Representative Lindsay. And just before I turn it over, I would note the handout that we just got, the map of the state and the names along the right side. I've had the good fortune to have some conversation with Chad Freeman, who's assigned to Washington County, where I represent, and we've had some conversations about the idea of a sort of concierge service. So I think it's fair to say that as far as we go now, this is a good representation of that, and that when you all have constituents who call and need help with these sorts of services, these people are good people to connect with. Is that fair?
Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, that's very accurate. I hasten to point out that when you look at this map, these are nine individuals. And that goes, again, Representative Bence, it goes more. I would also use that money to hire more individuals. If you look at it, Chad, Representative Reed, makes a good point. Chad is a very, very talented individual. He's covering Washington and Clackamas County. That's not near the coverage we need to touch every business, so we rely heavily on our website and our outreach and our partners, the Portland Development Commission, regional partners, all of those. They're very important to our success as well as we are to their success. So we're a very collaborative agency because we are so limited in our human resources and monetarily that we need these partners.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was interested in one of the comments that you just made about the critical importance of the loans for keeping Oregon businesses afloat. It, related to that, perhaps, is something that I wanted to ask you about today, since this is sort of an oversight, kind of informational hearing to just get a broad idea of what you do and what's going on. On the minds of everyone is how do we create jobs, or even how do we keep the jobs that we have now, and when there are businesses that are struggling and just on the edge, how do we keep them afloat? I want to ask you a couple questions along the lines of micro business or small business versus big business. I am very interested in the work that you've been doing that creates opportunities for exporting Oregon products, whether it's actual physical products or knowledge-based industry. That interests me greatly. On the other hand, I also do pay attention to statistics that we get from the U.S. Census and some other places. Now, this information is dated. There's a report from the U.S. Census 2006 that there were 309,000 micro-enterprises in Oregon. Huge number of very, very small businesses, people operating, you know, one or two or five people, but these businesses are doing things in their community, and these people are working members of the community and of society. There's also a statistic that Oregon's micro businesses and small businesses under 100 employees, between 1993 and 2008, over a long period of time, were responsible for creating 68% more jobs than the larger size businesses. So given that, very often what we hear about in the news are the big successes, the things that get a lot of attention.
Right.
But how much of your department's work, whether it's the concierge-type services or helping people with loans, how much of your work is working with our micro and small businesses to help them either keep afloat or expand by one or two people and maybe become that exporting business, a specialty food product, for example?
Representative Nathanson, members of the committee, I think that's a very good observation. I can't give you a direct percentage, and I can't differentiate between micro and small business, but I will say that between 90 and 95% of what we do day in and day out, this is the 9 business development officers, our 5 loan officers, and our 5 international officers. We work with small businesses. The programs we have are designed for small business, and the loan programs we have are designed for small businesses. On the micro side, it's very difficult for us because we're legislative. And by statute, it dictates how we use the money and the loans and what they need to be and how much they need to have in reserve. So we're not venture capital, which is what typically, you know, your micro businesses. But we, in every way, a good example of a micro business is, and what's the name of the dialysis machine?
HD Plus.
HD Plus. That was a micro business that came to us with an idea. And we, in turn, took them to Onami, who is funded through the Oregon Innovation Council, and they gave them $250,000 to prove their product, which, in turn, did prove out because we thought it would. It was a great idea. And then they've raised capital from New York, capital of $50 million, the largest venture capital raised in this state. And they're now producing that life-changing piece of equipment. So it's a roundabout way of answering your question. Whenever we can, we try to assist them in any way we can. But, again, we have limited resources to do that. But I say with assurance that 90% of what we do day in and day out is working with existing Oregon small businesses.
Thank you for the response.
Thank you. Representative Lindsay.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I applaud you for the wonderful return on investment. That's great. That said, there's always the 20-80 rule. That is 20% of one entity carries the remaining 80%. I'm wondering, what were the most successful ventures in that return on investment, number one? And number two is, What were the lessons learned or some poor investments? If you could drill down and explain that a little bit.
Representative Lindsay, members of the committee, we don't make poor investments, so I can't address that. Quite frankly, we invest in Oregon.
Lessons learned then.
Well, I have to say we've got a better rate on default rate on our loans than banks do. We're less than 2% over the last 10 years. If you want a good example, a company came to us called Novellus. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Most people aren't familiar with a lot of these high-tech companies that are here that are poised to grow. What we were faced with was they came to us and they were making a decision whether to take their existing manufacturing facility out of Tualatin, Oregon, and move it down to Northern California, where they also had a facility, or vice versa, move it up. So basically what we did was we really had no tools to help them make that decision other than the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund, and we used $500,000 of that to help them make the decision, and we promised them that we actually would introduce legislation in this session that would further help them, and I'll get to that legislation, but I want to point out what they did. They agreed if we were to give them $500,000 that they would move 130 jobs up to Oregon at an average salary of $70,000 a year. Okay. What's transpired as a result of it, they've actually created 200 jobs, and they didn't move them all. A majority of them came for Oregonians that were already living here. Their average wage is $73,000. That $500,000 investment has already been paid for. Okay, we've got the money back. Okay, and that money all goes into the general fund. These are lottery dollars that go back into the general fund that pay for schools and the services that Oregonians need. And I want to make that clear. This money, we invest it, but it goes back into the general fund, not back into the fund. So the legislation that's going to be introduced, it's House Bill
2162, and then there's a companion bill on the Senate Bill 219 that I believe Chair Reed was a chief co-sponsor of.
And I'll allow Paul to talk about that.
Sure. Chair Reed, members of the committee, I don't think I properly introduced myself before. My apologies. I'm Paul Grove with the Business Development Department. And the legislation that Tim referenced, again, it's House Bill 2162 and Senate Bill 219. And what it does, it builds off a study that we had done through a consultant out of Austin, Texas, to examine the state's tools and incentives that it has at its disposal in comparison to other states. And what the study found was Oregon was very strong in some of the loan programs that it administered for small businesses. It was strong in its incentive programs to help induce capital investment, but it didn't have any direct tools besides the governor's strategic reserve fund to incent jobs and wages, job growth and wage growth. So at the direction of our commission and Chair Van Valkenburg, we worked with Novellis and other folks from the industry, county, other electeds, to put forward a proposal that basically provides a one-time upfront award based on the number of projected new hires and the wages associated with those hires. It takes the new revenues that would be generated, puts it into a fund, and provides an award for those companies.
Thank you for the preview on the bill, too, which, as you note, exists both in this committee in the form of a House bill and in the Senate. We'll be paying close attention to see which one moves first and hope to advance that.
And Representative Lindsay, a member of the committee, and when I said that, I didn't mean to be flippant. I'm quite sincere when I say we haven't made bad investments. On the limited resources we've got, the return we're showing to the state, I'm quite proud of what we do.
Are there other questions?
Go ahead.
Let's go to Representative Smith, and then we'll come back to Smith.
No, after you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate what you said about homegrown businesses. Sort of a comment for the record related to some of the questions and comments from the committee. We know now, looking at the data from 1998 to 2008, that early stage businesses with growth potential are where essentially jobs have been created. Stage 1, Stage 2 businesses have grown 8 to 42%, and Stage 3 and Stage 4 businesses have lost little jobs. It doesn't mean Stage 3 and Stage 4 businesses aren't critical to our economic development picture. They are, but they haven't been as frequent a job growth driver. We've talked today and we'll talk again, but can you look at the Growth Florida model where they put in, just got the new data after we met today, $1.42 million into the Growth Florida program, focusing again sort of on those early stage businesses. Their new report says 1,458 jobs created. Before, I think on the record, I had said that it was about $4,000 a job. Based on that, they projected now on their new data, it's $1,000 a job. So it's, I don't know, they may be fudging their numbers, but according to their numbers, I think it continues to be something that we can look at. And I think we have some things that relate to that and could integrate with stuff that they're doing pretty well. Thanks a lot for what you're doing.
Well, And Representative Smith, Chair Reed, I appreciate the update from the meeting today, and obviously it's something that we'll work together and explore further to see you know, how we can better incorporate and address the needs of these businesses, in particular around the suite of services that we provide, to ensure that companies not only get the technical assistance that they need, but the market research and those other tools that are necessary to grow their business.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking that since we are the Committee on Transportation and Economic Development, we'll sure be looking to your department for your thoughts on what we should be doing. I just put that out there because it seems that you folks are in that business, and we sure want to hear from you.
I want to maybe build on that by asking the question that I sort of alluded to, and we certainly asked Director Garrett in his first appearance here, and that might be accomplished by sort of taking you into the future for a moment and considering a few months from now when this legislature adjourns, sine die, and how you might evaluate whether we've been a success from the economic development standpoint, and as much to build on Co-Chair Bentz's point, as specific as you can be, even saying accomplishing these things, removing these barriers, giving us these tools, that would be most helpful.
Yeah. Representative Bentz, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, I think that's a very good question. I'm going to consider this legislation, and I want to reference the governor's balanced budget. You may notice in our department, the only place where we're general funded is in the arts, where we use general funds, and we took the required 20% reduction in that. But in all of our other funding, the governor not only approved everything we asked for, he also added to the Film and Video Office, and he added $8 million to our Credit Enhancement Fund. Because, as you know, jobs, if you look at his website, jobs are his top priority. So I will consider this legislative session a success if I can get that budget through intact, okay, because these programs are extremely important to Oregon companies, okay, and It's something I asked for. It's something the governor actually exceeded what I asked for when we made our presentation. So a success for us, because we're very limited in our human resources, and his budget keeps everyone employed in my department. And the business side, which is only 58 people, okay, it's not big, okay, but they're extremely important. These programs are nothing without the people to deliver them, and having 9 business development officers, it would be a huge success for me if I could add 5 more business development officers, particularly around the more populated areas of the state. You know, so if you and, you know, your wisdom see fit to increase our budget, I'd feel even more successful. I hope that answers the question. And that, along with the incentives that we're in place that Representative Reed has introduced for existing Oregon businesses, that incentive is extremely important, because you need to know it's a very, very competitive world out there. And I don't know if you know it, some of our top competitors now are coming from the South. Texas is making a concerted effort to lure Oregon high-tech companies away. You know, and it's real, and we have no incentives to keep them here. If we lose those dollars, they're the highest paying companies we have. If we lose those dollars now to Texas, we're also losing the future dollars that they, you know, stand to gain. So,
thanks,
Mr. Chair.
You follow up?
Yeah, please. It strikes me as interesting that we haven't heard, and in this, from what you're saying, if we continue what we're doing, that's the proper path, and that's an answer that's acceptable to me. But I haven't heard a suggestion that the department thinks we ought to be doing something legislatively that would help our state economically, such as reducing regulations, such as streamlining this or doing that, or taxes. Is your focus, do you see the purpose of the department as working with the current situation and not trying to change it, and working with business in the environment it finds itself, and not trying to identify problems and other things that you would then bring to our attention and say, gee, by the way, legislature, you ought to be doing this or that?
Representative Bev, members of the committee. I'm remiss in not mentioning those things. You're absolutely right. There are things that we can do within the state to make it a better business climate, apart from taxes. Okay, I have to say, when we talk about taxes, and I'm talking to companies looking to expand or relocate to Oregon, we've got a very favorable tax structure, quite frankly, because we have that single source sales tax. They're not taxed on anything they sell outside of this state. And again, I'll talk about Novelis. They sell primarily to China. So the beauty of that is their items sell for as much as $5 million a piece, and all that those products go to China. All that money comes back into the state. If we didn't have that, another example is Genentech in Hillsboro, repackaging of chemicals and medicines. Without that single source sales tax, we would not have Genentech here. So I bring this up because the tax for existing Oregon companies, it had an effect, and I know that, but from a recruitment standpoint, it doesn't affect us. I kind of lost my train of thought.
A follow-up, if I may. I understand the point you are making, but what I'm getting at is I would look to your department for identification of those things you think are interfering with our competitive balance or what you think we should be doing other than simply giving the department more money to continue to do what it's doing. I would like more direction.
Sure.
At these other levels is what I'm asking.
Yeah. Representative Benz, co-chair Reed, members of the committee, it's a very good point. And what we're doing, where we find obstacles and roadblocks is more around land use policy and transportation. Those are things we have to deal with. And what we've done individually as departments, I want you to know, is Richard Whitman from DLCD and Matt Garrett and I meet monthly along with staff to identify problems that we're facing, you know, because everything, the decisions their departments make directly affect our ability to create jobs and wealth for the state. These monthly meetings are very beneficial because we can identify problems and work together to address those. In addition to that, we have our chairs of all of our commissions meet quarterly and go out to dinner, and we address these issues with them and look for those so we can bring that to you and look for those solutions. So we are doing that. And we're coming up with those. The good thing about that, what came out of that, these meetings was, and again, it happened out in Hillsboro, but there's an interchange out there on US 26, on Highway 26, that we had potential to really bring a large company in, but when that interchange is there, it prohibited us from doing that. Well, that wasn't on their radar. They were unaware of that until we brought it to their attention, and the commission acted upon that, and now we're getting the necessary improvements to it. So I think a lot of this is dependent on agency heads like myself working together with other agencies to solve some of these problems, but many of them are going to have to come to you, and you're going to have to make those decisions, and we'll help you with that. But it's a very good point.
Thank you.
We appreciate you bringing them to our attention, too. Representative Widener?
Thank you, Chair. Actually, Representative Bence was kind of hitting on the direction I wanted to go, which was I had several questions, land use, environmental, and tax structure on what is the biggest hindrance. And like Measure 6667, was that a benefit for you or a hindrance for you on recruiting businesses to come to Oregon? Same thing as land use. Is that something that's a hindrance for you, which it sounds like it is? And then the next would be environmental issues that we face with DEQ. Does that stop businesses from coming here?
Representative Widener, members of the committee, we do have obstacles. The land use, let me go back, and I don't know how many, you've all probably heard me talk about it because I was part of the group that made this happen, but back in 2003 we introduced the Certified Project Ready Site Program. Okay, and what that was, I worked at Pacific Corp, the electric utility, Pacific Power, at that time, and we came to the governor and said, look, we've got industrial land, but it's not ready to be developed. The permitting process in Oregon at the time took 18 months to 2 years, and these companies that were looking to locate here or expand here didn't want to wait 18 months to 2 years. So we created the Certified Project Ready Site Program, which said that if you choose this site, you can put a shovel in the ground in 180 days and start. And that was agencies working together to create that, to get the necessary permits in place. It was communities, counties, cities, everybody working together. And it was a huge success. We certified 12 sites initially in May of 2003. One of the sites was in Lebanon, Oregon, and I know Representative Reed's heard this and probably Representative Bent's countless times from me, but it really shows the success. The site in Lebanon had been on the market for 17 years prior to that. It was one of the original 12 sites that was certified. It was the first to go. Lowe's built a distribution center out there. Lebanon was a community that was dying. It was virtually, people were getting jobs outside of the community. They were moving out. Lowe's chose that as their distribution center, and at the time it was the single largest building in the state under one roof. Created over 1,000 jobs. Lebanon now is a vibrant community. They're building a medical school there. And I want to say that's a result of Lowe's picking that site. So the certified site program, and we've certified over 50 sites statewide. All of them have activity on them. But now we're faced with the tougher sites to find, the ones that have wetlands issues, the ones that have infrastructure needs, both electric and transportation needs. And we've got to figure out a way to make these more lands available statewide. And I'm talking everywhere from Portland all the way down to Medford and going east. It's going to be a big job going forward.
Thank you. Well, I, for one, could imagine myself being very happy having this kind of conversation for the rest of our meeting today and beyond. I suspect you'll be back with more specifics, but I do need to move along today in large part because we have four bills up for hearing and at least two members of the legislature who are patiently waiting behind you. So if there aren't any other last quick questions or comments, thank you for your first of what I suspect will be many appearances before our committee. And,
thank you very much.
I wish you a speedy recovery from
I'll try to be better.
Your maladies. Thank you. So we'll close the informational meeting on Business Oregon and happily note that we're undertaking some bills now. First on the docket is House Bill 2199. Is that the right one to start with? Yes. So we'll open a public hearing. And it occurs to me as we do that, we'll have the benefit, hopefully, of a summary from Zach, who arrived after our first organizational meeting. So I'd like to give him a quick chance to introduce himself. Some of you probably met him, but not everyone in the audience. So, Zach.
Thank you. I came from the Colorado legislature. I worked there for 3 years. Happy to be in Oregon. Lived just up the street. So it's been great so far.
Thanks very much. So if you could give us a summary on House Bill 2199, we'll get started.
House Bill 2199 sunsets the task force for the Oregon Opportunity Program. Basically, the task force was audited and has finished its assigned duties.
Very good. Senator Nelson, thank you for your patience and welcome.
Well, thank you, Chair. It was very interesting to listen to Tim talk about the economic development. I had quite a few thoughts about that. And if you guys are interested in a $700 million business, at some point I'll come and talk with you. But
you're welcome.
That's another subject. My name is David Nelson. I'm a state senator from, I live in Pendleton, District 29. I've been in the Senate since 1997. In 2002, then Senator Ryan Deckert and I got together on this Oregon Opportunity Grant. And basically, it was OHSU came to us and wanted to know whether if the state would come up with $200 million in bonding money, if they would raise $300 million in private funds. And it was a pretty controversial subject at the time, as it is now. You've got a University of Oregon situation going to it. They want some bonding money also for some matching private funds. But in this case, we agreed that we would do that. OHSU came up with over 300 million, but I think it was 372 or $378 million. And that project, when you drive into Portland, where you have the tram going up to Pale Hill, that's all the result of that. And very successful project, worked out wonderfully. We have, it's one of those public-private partnerships, I think, that it's probably what we're going to have to be doing in this session and in future sessions in order to get things done, to try and get people involved from the private sector. The government can't do it all. This task force has been in existence for the last 8 years, and Ellen Lowe has been the chair of it and taken very good care of us. And we've had some controversy, and we've had some issues that have gone on, but we've moved forward. I think you're going to probably get a report from the Secretary of State audit saying this is one of the more successful programs that we have initiated in the state of Oregon. It's really done everything it's going to do. The university, Oregon Health Science University, has kept its mission. It's expanded. I think we're only using 1 or 2% now of general fund monies for their entire budget. And they're in the top 20, I think, now of research institutions in the United States. And so, but we've got together and decided that, well, maybe it's time for the task force to be disbanded. So this is probably a good gesture on your part if you would listen to this bill and say, well, we will get rid of this task force. They've done their job. They do not need to be in existence, and it's time for us to move on. So that's the extent of my testimony. I have lots of things to say to this committee. I actually sit on the Ways and Means Committee of the Transportation, so we probably will be talking about some of these things.
And you're particularly welcome.
Anyway. Yes. This economic development issue is just such huge. You know, and the Northwest, Penmore, Pacific Northwest Economic Region was in the building. I don't know if you talked to those folks.
We did.
I talked with the Canadian fellow, and he was telling me they have a $19 billion surplus. And I'm thinking, how do you get to that point? Well, they have coal and oil.
Did you offer any suggestions on where they might send that surplus?
Yes, we don't want to ship it even through the state. So, you know, what I'm saying is, what I'm thinking is that if you folks, when you're talking about these economic development issues, the states that are successful are the ones that are going back to their natural resource base. And that's in an environmentally sensitive state such as Oregon, that's sometimes difficult to do. But if we want to be a successful state, if we want to fund education, I think we've got to go back to our natural resource base.
Thanks, Daniel.
So that's entirely different than Alan. I'm sorry, I'll let you take care of it.
Ms. Lowe.
Any questions for the senator before I start?
That's a good opportunity. I was thinking we would hear from all of you and then ask questions,
but
it doesn't look like there's any questions particularly directed to him. So,
okay, Chair Reed, co-chairs and members of the House Transportation and Economic Development Committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I appear today as chair of the Oregon Opportunity Task Force, and I really thank you so much for having this as one of your initial hearings for the task force. As Senator Nelson has indicated, we're ready. It's with the unanimous approval of the other 12 members, task force members, that I respectfully request that you view House Bill 2199 with favor and that you pass it to the floor with a due pass. And I think that when you hear from Dr. Daniel Dorsa, I'm confident that you're going to share our conclusion and also that of the Secretary of State, that we really did complete the assignment that we had from the 2001 Legislative Assembly, and I just had that distributed to you. You will see that our primary role was to review the impact of Oregon Opportunity on OHSU's core missions of teaching, patient care, research, and community service. Now, I served without portfolio or compensation as that advocate who's identified as being an advocate for persons who are medically underserved. But I came to that role with my longtime experience on the Health Services Commission, 16 years, and then on the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And I do admit leading the task force to give special attention to the review, really, of the maintenance of high-quality clinical care for Oregon's most vulnerable. And I found, and the commission found, that really, rather than being compromised by the Oregon Opportunity, This service really was enhanced by the additional connections that began to be built among all the functions at OHSU. Now, during this current time when Oregon has both a fiscal and a moral imperative to support quality care at less cost, I'd like to highlight just a couple of the contributions from the Hill and from down below in their facilities. And certainly the Center of Medical Excellence, they're providing us with worldwide respected, renowned information on value-based benefits. And those are going to be critical as we are making adjustments in the Medicaid program in Oregon. And then also, I wish to note the wide participation of the research and teaching and clinical faculty at OHSU on the many panels that have served Oregon's Health Services Commission in putting together the list. And it, now as the work is being refined to really give primacy to effective treatments rather than those that are marginally effective, I see OHSU as a continuing partner. Now, under our first chair, the late Senator Hartung, we began the practice of providing time at the end of our meetings for public comment. And on occasion, if there was something they were interested in, they could raise their hand and participate as we did our work. All of our meetings were posted. We observed the public meeting law, and I do not recall a meeting when we were without observers or public testimony. The public testimony, though, centered on the last of our legislative assignments, and that was to review whether animal research at the university is being done in an ethical and humane manner. Now, please note that our task was to review how, not if. We heard numerous allegations of mistreatment, so I appointed a subcommittee, including me, with former Representative Butler as the chair. And there were visits to the center and countless hours spent reviewing all the state and federal reviews, as well as hearing from the principals doing the research. The entire task force joined in much of this review and concurred with the subcommittee's findings that the research was being done in a humane manner and needed no additional oversight beyond the existing federal, state, institutional, and professional reviews. And I have to tell you, the materials I had was like a backstop. I really need to acknowledge the thoroughness and the professionalism of OHSU's response to the testimony that we heard from some of those folks who were our guests. And they did their work in what I need to characterize as a very hostile environment, which was created by those who brought the unfounded charges. And so while the investigation of these charges took many hours of task force and faculty time, fortunately it did not keep the task force from seeing the relationship and what I really would like to characterize as the interdependency of the medical research and teaching functions at the university. We can say that healing, teaching, and discovery can and do come together at OHSU. And I believe I speak for the entire task force when I say we're ready to view from afar the pursuit of medical excellence on the Hill and down below, of which we were just a small part. And now Dr. Dorso will talk about those who do the work.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would note it's not a common occurrence for a chair to come and advocate for the dissolution of his or her own body, so we especially appreciate your presence and your testimony. Dr. Dorsa.
Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. For the record, my name is Daniel Dorsa. I'm Vice President for Research at Oregon Health and Science University. This task force was formed shortly after I arrived here in Oregon from the University of Washington, and obviously, as you've heard, was there to address OHSU's ability to really keep its eye on the ball in terms of its other missions, the clinical mission, educational mission, and outreach. As you've just heard, this committee has worked very hard with us in trying to examine those issues. The statement that I provided to you attempts to evidence and detail in some detail the fact that, in fact, those missions have not been jeopardized by the investment that was made by the state and OHSU in its research mission. In fact, they were all augmented. And there are multiple ways to look at that in terms of national rankings and so forth. In medicine, U.S. News and World Report ranks primary care, family medicine, and rural medicine at OHSU in the top 10. Nursing, midwifery, gerontology, and other, their master's program, also in the top 10 by U.S. News and World Report standards. Innovative strategies to workforce development, and I should say we are training more medical students, more nurses, and more dentists and graduate students than we ever have before. You're probably may be aware of OCNE, which is the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Excellence, which is a statewide effort in that regard. And I hope you are aware of the Life Sciences Building, which is under, in still being planned and worked on with the Oregon University System. This gives us the opportunity to expand further our training activities in medicine, nursing, and dentistry, and to do that in an environment, a collaborative environment, with our partners in the OUS system. We're having more patient visits than ever before. In 2004, 489,000 patients came to OHSU. In 2009, 625,000. We see the sickest, most complex cases in the state. In terms of the synergy with the clinical mission, a lot of the recruiting that we did actually was for leaders in the clinical departments and the divisions that are responsible for delivering care at our institution, pulmonary and critical care like medicine, and the new chairs of cardiology and orthopedics were recruited with some assistance in the Oregon Opportunity money. The Oregon Opportunity was about creating critical mass in the research effort at OHSU, and as you just heard, and I think you know, the Secretary of State's audit looked at that. There were some targets and criteria that were established there about the recruitment of numbers of investigators. We recruited 94 investigators and additional 175 research staff. Achieved top 20 status, which was referenced in terms of NIH funding back in 2006. Built 275,000 square feet of additional new research space that was desperately needed to house those new investigators and, frankly, set the stage for future investments. In 2001, when I got here, the research funding coming in from outside the state to OHSU was $217 million, and in 2010, $392 million came into the state of Oregon because of the efforts of our faculty in achieving grant funding. We're a national leader now, recognized in many areas, and getting very large grants now from the National Institutes of Health. We are, frankly, in the top tier in terms of competing with the major players for those kinds of grants. Numerous scientific breakthroughs. Shukrat Mitalipov's work, one of our faculty members, was tied for first place in Time Magazine's Discovery of the Year, was on the cover of the 2008 issue. Quite frankly, one thing I want to point out is that if you'd go through and you track the investments and the people that we recruited or retained at OHSU and what they've done in terms of grant revenue associated with them, to date they've brought in about $230 million of additional money into the state to support their particular research programs. So if you take that against the $200 million that was invested by the state, I think a pretty good return on investment. It's not all about the metro area. We created a research network called the Oregon Rural Practice Research Network, which is a statewide effort that uses primary care practices and family practices throughout the state as a site for the conduct of research. It has brought in millions and millions of dollars of external grants, federal dollars, to support research being conducted on those sites and specifically addressing issues of importance to the delivery of care in those sites. How is it best to treat diabetes in a eastern part of the state and get good control as compared to in Portland? So, in general, I obviously could go on for a long time, but it's a remarkable thing that this state did. It's frankly one of the reasons I came here, because of the fact that the state made this investment in the institution. I believe it was a great investment. It has positioned us very well for the future, and hope to work with you further in the future about subsequent activities. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Dorsett. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but just a statement. Kind of funny, but this building is where my wife got pregnant last. let me explain.
It's always good to start a Friday afternoon.
Go ahead. Let me explain. So in reality, we did in vitro there, and it was we're patients of the great building and have very special relationship with the professional staff there. So thank you.
Glad to have you say that, Representative Lindsay. The not only for the explanation, but I was tempted to make some comments about the important role of OHSU in our economic development agenda. But it's a good counterpoint that it has a very personal and significant impact for a lot of people. So thanks for that, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we just witnessed what we know as a pregnant pause.
All right. Ooh, nice.
Sorry. Actually, I'm just curious. The $200 million jumpstart, $500 million jumpstart, do you suggest that we have to have a repetition of that? In other words, this happened. We've got a great result. What next?
Well, I would say it is possible in the future that that would be something that should be considered. However, the investment that you all made actually has, in addition to the grant funding and so forth I talked about, made it possible for people like Phil Knight to become interested in further investment in a big way in OHSU, the $100 million gift, which we are now using for a build of our cancer and oncology activities. So I do think there's follow-on still happening. I guess in the future, I would make an argument that it's a good investment. And so with deliverables and understandings about what is expected in return, I would think there's something to be considered for the future. In the interim, the budget challenges we're facing, like everybody else, we know you all have a very hard job, and we probably expect a reduction in our base budget. As you heard, it's 1-2% of our budget, but it's still real money. So we'd ask that you bear that in mind as you
go through your difficult deliberations.
Thank you.
Can I address that question? Just
please,
I mean,
Senator Nelson.
We're going to face that in this issue because you've got the situation. University of Oregon has a proposal. They want the state to come up with $800 million in bonding money. And they think they can raise some like amount and would eventually endow all of higher education. Now, there's a lot of pushback on that, but that's something I think that the whole body, senators and representatives, are going to be involved with. But it's, you know, you've got potentially $1 billion being raised in the private sector. It seems to me someplace in the legislature we can figure out a way, and maybe it's not bonding. I don't think the state has the capacity to bond $800 million. But is there another way for us to somehow get this private money in and try and make it into a successful project like OHSU did? OHSU, that's right.
So appreciate the context you put that in, because I think that is the lesson.
It's relevant.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely.
Because that proposal's there, and you've got $1 billion on the table. It seems like there's a way we can figure out how we can collect that for the betterment of higher education.
Well, we'll try to bring this story to the floor too, so that those who are dealing with higher education more specifically might learn from the OHSU lesson as well.
Chair Reed and Co-Chair Bentz, may I respond to your question,
please,
Co-Chair Bentz? I've often thought that some of your fellow legislators have forgot that when something's a public corporation, it really does not say there should not be public support. And so even though it's that very low percentage, how important it is for all of Oregon to be able to have OHSU serving all of it. And that is going to need continuing public financial participation in supporting it, because oftentimes we wash our hands of something when we create that public corporation. As you look at all those imperatives we have now in healthcare, and I look at workforce jobs really at the very top, and then the communication that needs to take place across the state, OHU is probably the fulcrum.
Thank you very much. I think we've had a pretty good description and discussion. If there are other questions about the bill from this panel, thank you for coming. We've also completed the list of people who had signed up to testify on this bill, but I'll ask if there's anyone else who'd like to be heard on this bill. And seeing that, looks like we've taken care of that. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2199 and open a work session on House Bill 2199. Colleagues, we have the fiscal and revenue impact statements, both of which indicate no impact, is that correct? So we are open to move the bill to the floor. It's one of those housekeeping matters that we have to be sure of, particularly before we move things to the floor. So, Representative Bentz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2199 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bentz has moved House Bill 2199 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of the motion? I don't see any. Is there any objection to the motion? I don't see any. The motion carries with unanimous support. Colleagues, is this the sort of bill, I would almost suggest that we might place this bill on the consent calendar, except that there might be a useful story to tell in very brief form about what was learned at OHSU and the positive result. Anyone feel like it should go on the consent calendar? Representative Smith?
I'm assuming by what you say that we have the consent calendar again. We didn't have the consent calendar during the special session. We're back to real life.
It's an option.
They have an interesting story to tell. I wouldn't object either way.
Sounds like you might be volunteering to carry the bill.
Crap.
What do you think?
By that I mean I'd be honored, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. House Bill 2199 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and Representative Smith will carry the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 2199. And Representative Krieger, thank you for your patience. If you're still here, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2185. Zach, if you could get us started, please.
House Bill 2185 names the bridge crossing Utah Creek on U.S. Highway 101 near milepost 317 as the Wilbur C. Moore Bridge. Also directs the Department of Transportation to create and post markers designating the name of the bridge.
Representative Krieger, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Bentz and Reed. For the record, I am Wayne Krieger, State Rep of District 1, South Coast, Southern Oregon. As you heard, House Bill 2185 is a request to name the new Euchre Creek Bridge on Highway 101 after Wilbur C. Moore. This is the first bill of this type I've done in 11 years, and I haven't done a memorial either, but you're almost going to get a memorial out of this. I had contacted ODOT Director Matt Garrett regarding the process of possibly naming this bridge and whether we should use the ODOT process. He suggested I just do it with a bill and that ODOT would not object. A little history. The old 101 was built running through the Moore family ranch sometime in the 1920s, referred to as the old Highway 101. And then in 1959 to 61, Highway 101 was moved more to the coast, about an eighth to a quarter of a mile closer to the beach. And again, it was running through the property that belonged to the Moores. And the ranch had been in the family for about 125 years. And, of course, the bridge we're talking about was replaced in 2010. One thing about Wilbur, he had all those years worked with ODOT regarding fencing and keeping his cattle off the highway, and there's always a lot of tires, debris, and stuff that would come off the highway because it's kind of a dike onto the pasture. He took care of that. In a book called More Characters, Legends, and Mysteries by former state legislator Walt Schroeder, he described Wilbur in this manner. Husband, father, grandfather, outstanding livestock producer, son of pioneers, community leader, good friend, are just a few of the terms that were used to describe Wilbur Moore. Wilbur was always ready to help other farmers and ranchers and young people in our community to learn about ranching. Wilbur was deeply involved in the community, serving on the Ophir School Board for many years, Gold Beach Union High School, Curry Intermediate Education District, Ophir Water Department, Farm Home Administration, and the Curry Livestock Association, other type of groups. He also served as the 4-H Livestock Club leader for many years and actually held pre-fair affairs at his ranch where his students could help learn how to present when they did go to the county fairs. And he also hosted Tri-County livestock and crop judging tours at his ranch during the early 50s. After listening, I was kind of hesitant because I got the word cow story here. And after listening to Representative Lindsay, I feel a little more comfortable. I want to tell you a couple of stories and how I relate. You got to remember, when this is going on, I'm wearing a blue state police uniform in those days, and I'm the local game warden. So, you know, my relationship might have been a little bit different. But Wilbur was always trying to help young people, and Colleen, my wife, and I had got the ranch, our tree farm, had a few head of cattle, but I had a cow kind of in distress. And she's going to have a calf, and the feet are out, and then the feet aren't out, and she's going around. So I call Wilbur. He says, I'll be right up. He comes up. We get her in the stanchion, and he says, take off your shirt. And so I take off my shirt, and you stick out your arm, and he pours this goo and brown stuff and slime all over my arm. He said, take this chain. He says, reach in there and put this around the calf's legs. And I'm looking in there. Yep. So we reach in there. We get it on, and he shows me how to jack it off and get it out of there. And he says, well, looks like the calf's okay, and looks like you guys are good for more than one thing, referring to me and my, I call it my prior life. On another occasion, as I said, Wilbur was always helping people, and he was up helping cut some hay, but he only had this little cub tractor that he was able to bring up. He didn't have his big tractor, and had a little sickle bar on the side of it. And he's coming down the hill, and he gets balled up with too much hay in that little sickle bar, so he waves at me to come over, and that cub tractor didn't have any fenders on it. He said, just get on that fender, that tire there, and he says, push. Well, when he pushed, it didn't back up. The tire spun. So the cleats took me underneath the chin, ran right on down my belly, threw me about 20 feet through the air, and as I went by, there was this astounded look on his face to see the game warden flying. And I ended up in the back there. Of course, he laughed afterwards, but all of us that lived in Curry County had something like that happen with that guy over all those years we knew him. He passed away September 3rd, 2008, at his home at Ophir at the age of 86, and he was a true pioneer for Curry County in Oregon. As a side note that you might want to remember if you think back, Logan Will was his grandson, and he died in an automobile accident in 2006, and he was honored here in 2007 on a current resolution 12 with Representatives Clem, Galizio, Maurer, and as chief sponsors, because he'd worked with Galizio, I think his campaign, maybe in his office some, but he was a great young man and had the proper genetics from Wilbur. I'll close there, and I hope that you would give the request favorable consideration.
Thank you very much. We have one other person who is here to testify, and if you can stick around, Representative Krieger, I think there might be some questions for you. At least I may have one. But if Tim Potter is still here, we'd love to hear from you. Mr. Potter.
Thank you, Chair Reed, Chair Benson, members of the committee, representative. My name is Tim Potter. I'm here from the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm here to speak about House Bill 2185, which is renaming the Euchre Creek Bridge. The bill authorizes the department to name the bridge the Wilbur C. Moore Bridge, as the representative has said. It's located on Highway 101 between Port Orford and Gold Beach, and the bridge is new. It was just open for traffic in March, so I want to say we would install and maintain bridges at both portals, both ends of the bridge. The signs would be brown, rectangular with white lettering, would face both directions of travel, and I think that's really all I have to say about that.
Does the department have a position on the bill?
We do not.
Okay. Very good. My only other question, I guess, would go to either of you. You mentioned in your testimony, Representative Krieger, that you had spoken about the possibility of working through an existing ODOT process as opposed to doing a bill, and I frankly just don't know very much about that process. Could you help us understand why you elected to go this route? Rather than
well, first of all, it gives me a little more control over what happens, okay. In all honesty.
Understood.
The second part, Matt Garrett actually recommended I use this process and just said, hey, it's not going to be much of an expense. We won't object to it.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions? Representative Sheehan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Potter, will the weight of Mr. Moore's good name create any structural or seismic issues?
Certainly not. Okay. Certainly not.
It's really going to be that kind of a day, Mr. Sheehan. You're just getting started. You know.
You think it was Gilliam's committee.
Oh, boy. That's right. Could be worse, couldn't it?
Yes.
All right. Any other questions? I don't see any. Very good. We have the fiscal and revenue impact statements as well, and they all, as you suggested and suspected, they indicate minimal impacts. So we have the ability to move this bill if we'd like to. You, Mr. Potter, were the only person who signed up to testify, but as usual, is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill? I don't see any. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2185 and open a work session on House Bill 2185. We're open for a motion if anyone would like to make one.
Move, Mr. Chair, that we move House Bill 2185 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith moves House Bill 2185 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of the motion? I don't see any. Is there any objection? I don't see any. The motion carries unanimously, and I expect, Representative Krieger, that it would make sense for you to carry the bill.
I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative
Krieger. Thank you very much.
Close the work session on House Bill 2185 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2733.
Zach. House Bill 2733 defines a target employment area and requires the Oregon Business Development Department to promulgate rules adhering to federal law. This allows for EB-5 federal funding. This bill declares an emergency.
Thank you, and I'll ad lib here for a moment while the sign-up sheet comes our direction. Thank you very much. Greg Peden is here, and Director McCabe, would you like to be heard on this, or is there someone from the department who might like to update us on what the department's doing with respect to EB-5?
Karen Gott.
Karen, please come forward.
I'll
and Karen, maybe we could start with just a brief, I didn't realize the director was going to come with you, but a brief explanation for the benefit of the rest of the committee who was not with us in the interim about what the EB-5 program is.
Okay. For the record, I'm Karen Godden, Division Administrator for Business Innovation and Trade Division, Business Oregon. I'm honored to be here today and to share with you an update on the EB-5 program. The EB-5 Immigrant Investor Program is a federal program administered by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, USCIS. It's a program that allows foreign investors to receive a green card upon meeting conditions of investing either $1 million in a new enterprise or a troubled business, and create 10 jobs resulting from that investment. And it's tracked for approximately 2 years to ensure that the requirements are met. Also, for the targeted employment areas, the TEA areas are designated areas where there's high unemployment that's at least 150% of the national average of unemployment. These TEA areas allow for a lower investment level of $500,000 via the foreign investment. Again, it can go into a brand new enterprise or a troubled business that is looking for an investment to help turn it around. Again, 10 jobs are required as a condition of this level of investment. I would also like to note, in addition to the individual investor at $1 million or $500,000, it's also possible for a regional EB-5 center to be established. A regional center allows for the pooling and grouping of investments, more than one investor. In fact, it's not capped on the number, but the requirements are that job creation, again, happen. At least 10 jobs have to be created through the investment for each investor. So if each investor puts in $1 million, or if it's in a targeted employment area and they put in $500,000, they have to, again, still create 10 jobs per visa request. However, under the regional centers, these investments are not just direct jobs that are created, but indirect jobs that can be created. Mm-hmm. So that is fundamentally the outline of the EB-5 program.
Thank you. And if you could also bring us up today, I understand it's there have been some recent developments or advances that the department has made with respect to your approach to this program.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Reed. Yes, we have actually implemented the TEA designation. What that means is that we have, through the authority invested in the governor by the federal program, to designate an authority that can identify and designate the TEA areas, high unemployment at a certain rate. We have done that and have released information and have on our website all of the areas that are now so-called, that are all designated as TEA locations. Again, rural areas qualify under this program based on the nature of the employment levels on average. The TEA areas really are designated for metropolitan areas where there's a larger population base, but certainly pockets of areas where there's high unemployment. So through the designation of these areas, investors can now proceed with the ability to apply for to the federal government for investor-related approval.
And I think you said this already, but is the definition you mentioned 150% the average? Is that's federally defined? And,
yes.
And the state's role is to certify that is true in certain areas.
Yes, and that we've designed a methodology and captured based on the requirements of the federal program, and we have done that. We have released that data. We are aware that there are already five EB regional center applicants who are working currently with the City of Portland in pursuit
A number of the TEA areas fall within the Multnomah County and region. We're also aware that the city of Beaverton is also engaged in working with several applicants who have applied for but not have formally been granted their EB5 regional center status. But we've already seen some activity attracting investment.
And you make a nice segue, giving me the opportunity to note for the record and the committee's benefit that we just received some written testimony from the City of Portland that supplements what you're saying. So
okay.
Please go ahead.
Okay.
Very good. So it's worth some note of explanation just before we ask if there are questions from the committee that we introduced this bill in the interim, not knowing, and I think perhaps prior to your good work on this front. So it appears, unless I learned something subsequent to my statement here, that this bill is no longer needed, but it was perhaps played some role in supporting your efforts.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Any questions? I don't see any. So thank you very much. Mr. Peden, if you'd like to be heard, we'd love to hear from you.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Greg Peden, I'm here this afternoon on behalf of American Pacific Investment Corporation. The acronym is APIC. APIC is an EB-5 applicant under the federal program. They are an investment firm headquartered in downtown Portland. They last year purchased the Coin Tower and own a couple of other pieces of property in downtown, and have applied for the EB-5 program. We've worked since early last summer with Karen and the department to establish these TEAs and submit the application to the federal government. We expect to see an application approved from CIS hopefully in the next 30 to 60 days. And we, Co-Chair Reed had indicated when we first got into this, this is a relatively new tool for being used in Oregon. There are other regional centers and other EB-5 applicants around the country that have been approved and have brought in for investment. But this group of five different investors or investment groups that have applied in Oregon are the first. And so this is relatively new in the last year or so in Oregon. And I think, as Co-Chair Reed indicated, we thought that some legislation here might provide the department with some guidance, but I think certainly would be our judgment in the interim that it probably is no longer needed. So simply to say, the department's done a great job. They've been a great great partner in working with us, and we certainly would support whatever direction the department and the committee would agree upon.
Thanks very much. I neglected to ask when the department was here, but I'll ask you, and maybe they can indicate by nodding or shaking their head. Can you identify anything that the legislature ought to be doing to facilitate further progress on this project? In other words, do we need to do anything with this, or is this a vehicle to make your jobs easier? No, they're indicating that it's not needed at the moment. So I think that takes care of that, and we appreciate your testimony. Thanks very much. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2733. We have a message outstanding to Representative Clem on House Bill 2870. He was here earlier, and we expect him to be back momentarily so that we can hear from him on that bill. And until he arrives, unless he's walking in the door now. He's not. We'll stand at ease for a moment. Welcome back from our brief respite. Thank you for joining us, Representative Clem. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2870, and Zach, if you could give us a quick summary.
House Bill 2870 makes the governor the official international, or excuse me, makes the governor the official international trade representative for Oregon, specifies that the Secretary of State would serve as that role in the governor's absence.
Welcome, Representative Clem. If you could bring us up to speed on why this bill is needed.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Reed, Chair Bentz. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21, which is here in Central and East Salem. So this bill is largely what happens now already, actually. The governor is it's not listed, but the governor is our official representative abroad, and the Secretary of State is generally who they use, and that's the protocol according to both Madam Secretary Brown and governors, both governors in recent history that I've talked to about it. The issue really is an experience that Representative Richardson, Wisnant, and Senator Edwards and I had in Guangzhou in September on our official Fujian sister state delegation trip. And so what happened was, and I think it's because of the U.S. Secretary of State title and what that means for foreign policy, but it was Virginia had a line about 80 people long to take pictures with their Secretary of State, and we've got a booth, you know, we got nice DVDs and stuff playing and exciting pictures of Oregon, and I mean, we got a few people to come to our booth, but not very many.
You didn't take the pictures from Representative Bentz's television then?
I didn't. I should have. That was the major problem. That and no pears or cherries or really anything, you know, tasty to give out. So it's pretty clear that at least in China, which is our number one trading partner, the Secretary of State means significantly more than anything other than the governor. And our protocol, apparently, from what the governor tells me and the Secretary of State, that's generally what happens. You may remember last May, our governor couldn't go because he had a former governor. He had an eye issue and he had couldn't travel. And so they asked Secretary Brown, she could go, she couldn't go. So they asked the treasurer, the new treasurer, just been appointed treasurer, if he could go. Wasn't sure if he had a passport. They figured out that he did and got everything going, and he made the trip on behalf of the state. So what this does is essentially clarifies officially the practice that we've been engaging in. That and it's drafted in a way that really sort of is about the governor. That wasn't really the issue for me. It was really the Secretary of State, because the governor really is already our official trade and nobody disputes the governor leads our trades and missions, if at all possible. And that's the very best way to do it from a interest level perspective from the other country. But the Secretary of State means something different nationally than it does here in Oregon. And in many states, it means what it means nationally, meaning Secretary of State, that is their job. They do international trade promotion as well. And this would essentially formally add it to the Secretary of State's duties. And I talked to Secretary Brown about it. There's no problem with it. Again, it's sort of what happens anyway if the governor doesn't, and this would formally place that in their job descriptions.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who has signed up to testify on this bill? There's not. Okay. So I want to make sure I understood what you said. Or maybe I should, rather than hazard a guess, I should ask you to clarify. Are you, what would be the benefit? This bill passes, what's the positive, and why is it different than the status quo? If I heard you right, this is what happens already.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, for example, let's say the governor was completely incapacitated, and the governor wasn't physically able to make a decision, and the staff's looking for direction on who do we ask, this would guide that. This would be the legislature saying, this is who you ask next, not who you think it should be. This is who it is.
But what's the difference in this instance, and I know that there are at least a couple of attorneys on this, three, in fact, on this panel who could probably speak to this better than I, but does this depart from the otherwise defined order of succession?
No, status quo could depart from the otherwise order of succession, and this would affix it. So, for example, Governor Kulongoski was an eye issue. He didn't need to vacate the office.
here, this would dictate who would be next, even though not officially dysfunctional to the point of having to have the secretary become governor.
So it's in the case when he is has a limited incapacity. In the case that you mentioned, he couldn't travel but otherwise could fulfill the duties.
Or, Mr. Chair, usually it's going to be they're busy. I mean, that's usually the issue. They're busy, they can't go, they can't lead a trade delegation. Who can do it? And this would say it's going to be the Secretary of State, rather than, you know, it takes away a little flexibility from the governor, frankly, rather than whoever they want to lead it. It would say the next person officially is our Secretary of State.
Okay. Does the, I wouldn't want to make you represent the other people, but do the offices mentioned here have a position on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary of State's office, you know, I've talked to both her chief of staff and her directly. No problem. Talked to the governor's chief of staff. Didn't say one way or the other. So I can have that conversation with the governor.
So you would say they're both neutral, your understanding at the moment?
Yes. Yeah, I wouldn't say support. I would say neutral. No problem was the word used.
Okay, understood. Yeah. Questions from the committee? Representative Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So right now, if the Secretary of State went, they would see her as that person. I'm just trying to see a need or why we're doing anything with this bill, I guess, would be my question. Because they would, if Kate Brown went, they would all want their picture with her. So now we're saying, hey, officially you can have your picture taken with her? Or?
No, essentially, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, we're saying the legislature, and this is, I mean, this would have to be voted on by the people. The people of Oregon are saying who our number two is, not the governor asking who our number two is. We're saying who our number two is. And it could be somebody else. I mean, somebody, a governor could pick the head of Business Oregon. And what I'm asserting is that's not as good. I've been there. I've seen it. It will hurt our trade if you don't use the Secretary of State and use somebody else. I've witnessed it firsthand.
Further questions? Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it a situation where it's not enough that the governor designates someone? You know, they actually have to get to China or wherever and be the real thing. They can't be a deputy governor or lieutenant governor or vice secretary of state or deputy. It's got to be the real thing. Is that what those folks are looking for?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, exactly. So, for example, there was discussion about having the former governor's chief of staff go, and I got word from China that would be an insult. That you said the governor's coming. We want to see an elected official of the caliber. As close as we get to the governor, you would be insulting us if you sent a staff person, unelected. So I went back and said, you know, I think we're going to have a problem here if we don't find somebody else. And Representative Richardson was really concerned about the message we send to our number one trading partner. If when our governor has a medical issue, you just send their staff. They viewed that as problematic. I don't really, for me, this isn't so much about trying to tie the governor's hands. It's if we are going to grow jobs in this economy, it's going to be, a lot of it's going to be through export. There's no doubt about that. I mean, that's the way it is. Having said that, if the Secretary of State's qualifications that people are voting on when they're looking at Secretary of State don't include this, and they're voting on people based purely on, you know, their spot on the land board or whether they can run audits well or they're good at, you know, registering voters or just good at public speaking or whatever, to me that's a problem. So I would like to see, while the voters are looking at the qualifications of Secretary of State, this would be now one of the job duties in the voter's guide that they would look and they'd say, can this person represent this state internationally? Are they interested in international trade in any way? If we had a lieutenant governor, that might be the more appropriate person, frankly. But again, because of the Secretary of State title that the United States has, they really think the Secretary of State is like a miniature, you know, Hillary Clinton position or Henry Kissinger position, and they think it's a really big deal, and they line up to talk to the person. It's rather entertaining.
Follow up?
Well, I have a solution, Mr. Chair. We need a co-governor.
Co-governor. Interesting concept. Yeah. Representative Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, for me, I'm kind of seeing this rather an untie to kind of leave the governor some flexibility, but if he's just selected an elected official, whether it's a senator or representative, because we obviously had elected officials there with you and Dennis, and there's a lot of other representatives that were there and senators that were there. If he appointed an elected official to the position to represent Oregon, wouldn't that be more effective? Because what if for some reason he doesn't feel the Secretary of State's going to represent his positions and what he wants with China?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, it's probably true that the governors would rather have that flexibility. I'm asserting that the Secretary of State is our next best person. Whether the governor at that time views that or not, I'm saying this would be the people of Oregon voting to make that, and I think the people of Oregon have actually a better sense of this than even any given governor would have. And if they believe that's the right job description for the Secretary of State, they'll vote for this. If they don't, they won't. Yes, it would limit the governor's flexibility a little bit, and that's what the chief of staff for the governor said. He said, well, in some cases, we might want to send someone else. And I'm sure they could probably work that out, but if there was a conflict and, you know, the Secretary of State and the governor were of opposing viewpoints and the Secretary of State's a duly elected official with this as part of their job description, the Secretary of State would go, even if the governor, you know, they could decide to go themselves. I mean, that's the other option. They could just go themselves. But if they don't want to go or they can't go, this would guide who goes next. And I, you know, just from experience, it's stronger to have your Secretary of State there than a treasurer or a labor commissioner or something. Even though we have had ours travel, it's just not the same thing.
Does the bill need to then specify the order of succession further along?
I don't think it does, Mr. Chair. I wouldn't try and pick the rest of that. I would just let the governor figure the rest of that part out. Because I really couldn't tell you how to pick between those other ones. Nothing else matters compared to Secretary of State or a Lieutenant Governor if we had one.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to engage, but I got interested all of a sudden with some of these questions, because I had the same sort of question. What happens if the Secretary of State can't go? I think you just said the governor picks. Does the bill say that, or... does it need to? The second question, in case you feel like the best answer to that question has already been given, part of the challenge, so part of this is a nomenclature challenge, right? Because our Secretary of State is different than the federal Secretary of State. Our Secretary of State doesn't. Like, its primary day-to-day duties aren't related to national trade. It's the remainder of the Secretary of State's portfolio is not particularly helpful to the decisions we need to make around international trade. There are a couple, like land board, there's a couple things, but, you know, the day-to-day operations, when you look at the direct reports of the Secretary of State's office, and it's not going to do China much good. So I'm wondering if we want to designate somebody to make them really official, do we want to use the Secretary of State because that's the name they know, or do we keep the Secretary of State as an option because that's the name they know, and designate somebody where we're not picking by title, because the title's already fancy and important, but what we're picking around is duties that overlap with what's relevant international trade decisions. And I don't know, maybe it's the treasurer. You said Business Oregon.
It might even vary depending on what the particular trip is centered on.
What the visit is. And so I've got, that's another question. Maybe you have a thought. Maybe we'll noodle on it. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I can assert to you from experience, if they can get on a plane and have the title Secretary of State and spit out ni hao, that's more important than 10 years worth of training or experience or office staff or skills, and I personally will guarantee that to you.
No, that I get, but this bill doesn't help them with that, because the thing that helps them is the title. If this bill would help with that if it actually made the Secretary of State go, and maybe that's the point, is that we're going to say, Governor, you can't go, it's the Secretary of State, and I got a statute that says you're supposed to go, Kate, and if you can't, you know, that's bad or whatever. I don't know. Maybe that's the thing. But it seems like the bill doesn't help amplify the Secretary of State. Maybe it helps encourage them to attend. A thing that might be helpful by this bill or another, or an amendment to the bill, is trying to fancy somebody else up. You know,
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, unless you create a lieutenant governor, no.
We have a bill for that in the legislature this year.
The answer, really, in my mind, again, is create an expectation, if you're going to run for Secretary of State, that this is part of your portfolio, and the voters would have already blessed that concept, or else this won't pass. I mean, we're not asking you to make this a law. This is a constitutional referral.
Yeah.
And so if the voters end up or it should be. If it's not drafted that way, it should be. That's why I think it says be enacted by the people of the state of Oregon. You would run for office in the Secretary of State with this being part of your portfolio. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have those skills, when you're in a candidate's debate on that topic, you could speak to that part, I guess. You could say, well, I can learn, you know, Chinese, I could learn Japanese, but you may not win the office if you don't have this skill set. Mm-hmm. If we think we could weasel out another, you know, a couple hundred grand for a lieutenant governor, that's better than Secretary of State, probably. I didn't see a lieutenant governor at any of these trade shows I've been to. I only saw the Secretary of State, and I saw the line, and I saw the lack of line in every single other one, both from a state perspective.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, I'm still rolling all of this around and stuff, but I'm just wondering if I would rather see it specified that the governor select an elected official, and then that person wear the temporary duty of lieutenant governor or something like that, so you'd still be at the same capacity, you just have a new title when you're going abroad, because you would be the lieutenant governor for that trip.
Well, I should
temporary
lieutenant governor for a day.
Yes, we have honorary pages. I guess we could
honorary governor.
I should note, and maybe I should have said this earlier on. We don't have the fiscal and revenue statement, so the discussion here is useful and might inform future action. But we're not going to be able to move the bill today anyway. Right. So. With that in mind, that's an interesting thought. Other comments? I don't see any. So you've introduced an interesting concept, and we may return to it.
Hey, Mr. Chair, obviously, I would invite you all to attend these trips. You'd see exactly what I'm talking about. I wouldn't have to explain anything, I don't think. And you might come to different conclusions, but, you know, until I went on one of these with Dennis, who, you know, will drag you all along eventually, I'm sure, on one of these, it's really hard to understand this. I mean, I really frankly thought when I went to Beijing that I was going to see bicycles and uniforms. And instead, it's a city full of BMWs, Mercedes, and people on iPhone 4s. Their middle class is larger than our entire country now. And, you know, they went in a very slow year from I think just under $3 billion, which put them at our number one trading partner, to almost $4 billion just this year alone. And it's, you know, it's where the job growth for our state is going to come from, to a large degree, is selling there. And because that's where the market is.
It would be a fun trip for a lot of reasons, but particularly if we could go with Representative Smith and see how long the line is to see him.
I think it would be huge, really.
Representative Lindsey?
That's where Tyler.
Sure. No, I think the strongest argument is that it designates part of the job title as the trade person. I think that's the strongest argument. The weakest argument to me is that we're already dependent a lot on China, and it seems like we're reacting to China. Maybe we ought to expand this to not just China, but worldwide, because I just always get a little knot in my stomach when we're responding and reacting and morphing in response to them.
I assume the argument is just that China is an example. And that
I know, but
yeah.
I focus on the stronger argument of part of the job title.
Understood. Okay. If there aren't any other comments, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2870. House Joint Resolution 1 is on our agenda, but we have, since the time it came onto our agenda, we have learned that some additional work is needed and that it is not ready for a public hearing. So we'll be carrying that over and perhaps taking it up at a future date. Having, in the words of our revenue co-chair, exhausted our agenda, we are open to any last comments for the good of the order. And if not, we'll give you 11 minutes extra today, and I'm sure take it up at a future meeting. We're adjourned.